Thank you. Thank you all for being here today. I'm George Barna. I'm privileged to be able to speak with you today about a number of things that I think are really important for our culture. You may know me from some of the books I've written. I had started something called the Barna Research Group back in the 1980s. I sold that in 2009. Currently, I serve as a professor and the director of research of the Cultural Research Center at Arizona Christian University. And it's there that we do a lot of research related to what's going on in our culture today. And it winds up in some of the books like Raising Spiritual Champions. And that's what I want to delve into today. I want to talk with you about children, parenting, discipleship, and worldview. Those are all vitally important to what's going on in our culture today. You know, during the course of this session, I want to address the fact that Christian parents are called to optimize their life of service to God by producing disciples first and foremost. Their children are not given to them by mistake. They are there to raise them up to be Christ-like. And so it's vitally important that parents not only understand that obligation, but have some clues about how to do that effectively, because it's a difficult cultural context in which to raise children these days. Raising your child to become a disciple of Jesus really becomes a central measure of your success in your life as a parent, as a follower of Christ. And there may be many other things that you want to see your children do or become, but what I've found is that often those become distractions. They become barriers or obstacles to us being able to raise our children to be those kind of disciples. And so in order to be most effective at this process of raising our children to become disciples, we have to work on their worldview, help them to develop a biblical worldview specifically. So we're going to talk about a number of different things today. We're going to talk about what is your primary goal if you're a parent in terms of raising your child, or if you're a grandparent in terms of helping your children to raise your grandchildren. What kind of life are you trying to equip them for, and how do you think you're going to do that? How much of yourself are you going to invest in that process of raising your children to be disciples of Jesus? What is the nature and the purpose of your relationship with both Jesus and your children? And what are some of the keys to helping their life to become more successful? What we want to do ultimately is to understand that Jesus gave us a very clear assignment at the end of his 3 years of public ministry. We tend to call it the Great Commission. We've all heard it preached about, taught about, maybe you've done that as well. But really, it's in Matthew 29, verses 18 through 20, he leaves us with the charge of making disciples. And he tells us something very significant about that. First of all, the fact that he's given us all authority under heaven and earth to do that. He's given us the tools that we need to accomplish this. He talks about us doing this with people in all nations. In other words, everyone, everywhere, all the time. That's when the Great Commission is relevant to our lives. He tells us that we're supposed to enable them to make a public commitment of their faith. And we tend to call that baptism. And the fact that we should teach these new disciples to obey all of his commands. Paul later on wrote something in Galatians 6 where he said, you know, you reap what you sow. And so hopefully we are sowing those elements that will enable our children to become disciples, because that's what we want to reap from our efforts. You know, we can talk therefore about how is it that we define somebody as a disciple. And if we go back to the dictionary, it talks about a disciple being someone who follows a teacher or a master. And that individual in following that teacher accepts and learns and then applies their teachings and actively spreads those teachings as well. That's what makes someone a disciple. But it's kind of interesting in the research we've been doing the last couple of years at the Cultural Research Center. One of the things we also looked at is, what do American Christians think make somebody a disciple. And we found quite a different definition. In fact, we'll get to that in a moment. Before we get to that, I want to talk about how did Jesus define disciples? Because if we're talking about making disciples of Jesus, and he went to the trouble to tell us what constitutes a disciple, we ought to have that in mind. And so there were six times in Scripture where Jesus talked about, you will be my disciple if, or you cannot be my disciple unless. And so in the book of John, he had the you will be my disciple if statements. There were three of them. And the first one was in John 8, verse 31, where he said, you will be my disciple if you obey my teachings. A little bit later in John 13, he talked about you will be my disciple if you love other disciples. And then in John 15, he talked about you will be my disciple if you produce an abundance of spiritual fruit. And by that, he meant go out and make disciples. And then there are three passages in Luke 14 where preceding each, he said, you cannot be my disciple unless. And he started out by saying, unless you love God above and beyond everything else. Right after that, he said, you cannot be my disciple unless you submit yourself to God's authority. Now, the way he said it, you probably know it better as pick up your cross and carry it and follow me. But in that Roman context, basically what he was saying was you must submit to the prevailing authority. And God himself is always the prevailing authority. And then he ended that passage by talking about you cannot be my disciple unless you fully surrender everything in your life for my agenda, for my purposes, for my kingdom. That's what makes somebody a disciple, these six things. Basically, what Jesus was describing is the complete transformation of an individual. Everything about their life must change from what comes natural to us in our cultural context. And ultimately, in order to be that kind of transformed person, you're going to have to develop a particular type of worldview. And that's what we as parents or grandparents or teachers, coaches, whoever has influence on children, that's what we're called to do, is to help those children shape their worldview such that every decision they make would honor and glorify God and advance his kingdom. Now, this is Jesus' disciple definition. Let's look at what Christians in America think of as being disciples. What we found is typically they'll have one, sometimes multiple, but often one idea about what makes somebody a disciple. We found that the dominant ideas that American Christians possess is that you identify yourself as a Christian and as being a good person. You look back and find, well, that's not really what Jesus said. But that's the way we tend to think about it. If we try our best, if we're always doing the best we can, that makes us a disciple. We found other Christians said, well, a disciple is somebody who regularly attends church. Once again, nowhere to be found in the six criteria that Jesus gave us. Other people said, well, a disciple is somebody who believes in God or believes in Jesus. And that's certainly part of being a disciple, but that can't be the extent of it because even Satan himself believes in the existence of God, knows that Jesus is all-powerful and righteous. And so that can't be it. Other kinds of things we heard from people were a disciple is somebody who reads the Bible. A disciple is someone who prays to God, who's been raised in a Christian home, who's completed a discipleship program at their church. All of these are good things, but they are not the way that Jesus thinks about what makes somebody a disciple. So I'd encourage us to go back to what Jesus said and take those as our understanding of disciples. See, there's a real disconnect between the way that we tend to define these things and the way that Jesus did. And what we find out is that unless we have intelligent and strategic and consistent and biblical spiritual intervention, our good intentions are going to amount to very little, if anything. What we know is that currently in America, a large majority of young people, the people before their teenage years, frankly, are not attracted to the Christian faith or its churches. We also know from our research that most children who are involved in a Christian church today, statistically, are likely to drop out of that relationship with a Christian church before they reach the age of 25. We know that very few churches effectively minister to children or raise them up to be genuine disciples, and we'll look at that in just a few moments. And we know that fewer than 1% of all pre-teenagers and teenagers in America are on track to have a biblical worldview. So, you know, we need to rethink how it is that we're going about making disciples in America. What we've been doing isn't working, so we can't just keep doing more of it and do it more intensely. We need to rethink the process. And maybe we can start by thinking about what not only what discipleship is, but how does discipleship work? First of all, recognize that it's a choice that we make. You don't have to become a disciple. In fact, I'm going to share statistics with you in a few moments that indicate a huge majority of Americans have chosen not to be disciples of Jesus Christ. You become a disciple of Jesus, first of all, by genuinely believing in him, but then by doing everything you can to comprehensively imitate him. Remember, we talked about that's what a disciple is, somebody who imitates Jesus. The critical insight for you to remember here is that we do what we believe. So your beliefs matter greatly. Why? Because that's what gets translated into a lifestyle. If you want to know why people do the things they do, it's because they have underlying beliefs that propel them into that course of activity. And so there's a hand-in-hand relationship between beliefs and behavior. We ultimately wind up doing what we believe. If we didn't, we'd have constant internal agitation where we believe one thing, we do another thing, and we just feel uncomfortable and anxious about that. And so what we try to do is blend those things together so that they're in harmony. Therefore, to live like Jesus, what this means is first, you've got to think like Jesus. That's the belief portion. And the Bible provides us with everything we need to know about how to think like Jesus. Nothing needs to be added to what it teaches us. And we know, too, that not only if you want to live like Jesus, do you need to think like Jesus, but when you accept what the Bible teaches us, you embrace that as your set of core beliefs. Ultimately, the combination of those principles becomes your worldview. That's a very important element of your life. There are many different worldviews that people can choose from, but what we're looking for people to embrace is what we would call a biblical worldview. And that becomes absolutely critical to being his disciple, because you can't think like Jesus unless you have a biblical worldview. Why does that matter? Because you're not going to live like Jesus unless you think like Jesus. So these things all fit together. Now recognize that everyone has a worldview, not necessarily a biblical worldview, but everyone has a worldview. We develop that at a very early age in our lives. In fact, what we know is that a worldview serves as the intellectual, emotional, and spiritual filter that we use to experience and understand and interpret and ultimately respond to the world. You need to have a worldview to make sense of the world. Otherwise, it's just a jumble of activities and ideas and concepts and relationships and experiences that you have no framework for understanding. Your worldview gives you that framework to make sense of your world. It helps you to answer the big questions of life. Things like who you want to be when you grow up, how you're going to choose to live, what it is that you're going to believe at the core of your being, how you will identify yourself to the world, what really matters to you, how you're going to view and interpret the world, what you want to contribute to society, perhaps what kind of a legacy you want to leave behind. And so it's your worldview that helps you answer all of these kinds of questions. Essentially, it is the sum of your beliefs and your behavior. It's important to recognize that at least in the United States, in our cultural context, I believe it's a little bit different in some other nations, but in the United States, what we know is that a person's worldview begins developing at 15 to 18 months of age, and in most cases is fully formed by the age of 13. That shocks many people because we tend to think, oh, that can't be, because when we go to church, that's what we're trying to do there is form people's worldview with the adults so that they can go out and live it. Surprise, too late. What we know is by the age of 13, we've had to answer all of these questions because we confront them day after day after day. We can't wait until we're 18 or 22 or 25 to develop answers to the tough questions of life. And so what we know from some research that we did, it's called longitudinal research, where you take the same people and you interview them at intervals over time. And so every few years, we interviewed a large national sample of people tracking their spiritual development over the course of their life. And one of the key things we looked at was their worldview. And what we discovered is that most people in America will die with what is essentially the same worldview they had at the age of 13. Didn't change much at all. Now, we figured out how to articulate it better, how to refine some of the rough edges of it. Sometimes we changed elements of it, but not the core of that worldview. That remained the same for almost everybody. There are times when a person's worldview will radically change, and we'll talk a little bit about how that happens. But what we know that if your worldview is going to change, it's not only rare, it's very difficult. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort for that to happen. And generally, it requires some kind of a major crisis in a person's life, which is the thing that triggers new questions about, do I really understand what life is about? Am I really trying to be the person that I should be? All of those kinds of questions. And those crisis points in life are critically important for a person's worldview. But even there, what my research shows is that most people go through the crisis and revert back to their existing worldview as a place of security rather than something that they need to re-examine. And so these first 13 years, first 12 years really of a child's life are perhaps the most critical years in their life. What I've found in researching worldview for more than 40 years now is that there are four stages of worldview in a person's life. And those first 12 years are where young people are absorbing information and experiences and trying to make sense of it all. And they're experimenting with different ways of reacting to and responding to that information and those opportunities so that ultimately they establish what they believe to be the truths of their own life. And then during their teens and their 20s, that tends to be a period of time where we are trying to figure out, how can I communicate these things that I've landed on, that I believe in firmly, to other people? And how can I refine some of the things that I wasn't quite sure how they fit together? How can I make sure that I'm constantly and consistently applying these things in my life? And then when we reach our 30s and into our 40s, 50s, and 60s, that's a time when virtually every American becomes an evangelist. Now, a lot of people say, whoa, I didn't know that. Yes, the sad news is that they're typically not becoming evangelists for Jesus Christ. They're becoming evangelists for themselves. Because what they want other people to do is to embrace their worldview because they're so certain that they got it right. And there's a real ego boost when you see other people imitating you. And so many Americans are out there trying to profess that they know the way. If you would just do or believe what they do or believe, you'd be so much better off. Unfortunately, it's a minority of people who are out there trying to point people to Jesus and saying he is the only way. But we also know then that when we get into our late 60s, 70s, and beyond, that's a time when most Americans, if they make it that long, reflect on how they did and think about, gee, did I get it right? And there are some instances where people at that point in their life go through the tough stuff of trying to redo their worldview because they realized through their hard-won experience they didn't necessarily get it right. Let's take a little bit of time and focus on that first phase, those first 12 years, when a person's worldview is being initially constructed. We really can't discuss effectively those first dozen years or so without talking about parenting and what parents are doing. Now, we know that the scriptures talk quite a bit about the role, the responsibility, the spiritual obligations of parents to their children. And so as we go through the scriptures and look at those passages and learn the principles that God wants us to understand, it talks a lot about what we're to do to discipline our children, to guide them in the right ways, what we are to do in terms of teaching them respect and submission, what we're supposed to do in terms of taking care of their needs and showing them compassion as they struggle, and what we need to do to teach them about God and His ways, His principles, His truths that He gives to us in His Word. That's a vital part of what parents do on earth. In fact, if we're trying to figure out as an individual, if I've had children and I want to know, was I successful in life? So much of the answer to that question comes back to, what did I build into the lives of my children or my grandchildren? We are to be major, major influences in who they become. Now, we can't personally determine what choices they make, but we can influence those choices. Now, part of the challenge that we face is that we are not the only ones trying to influence our children. In fact, as I study culture, one of the things that we do at the Cultural Research Center is try to understand, how does the culture get transformed? How is it being transformed today? Who's doing the transforming? What does that look like? Is it positive in light of biblical teaching? And one of the things that we've discovered is that with children, there tend to be six dominant influence agents. And we know that those are the arts and entertainment industry and all the media vehicles that they produce. We know that it's family, primarily through the parents. We know that it's their friends, their school, the government. Some people say, government, how could that be an influence? Through laws and public policy, it has tremendous influence on people's worldview. And also the news and information media, how they report what's going on in the world and their editorial comments related to that. These things tend to have the greatest influence on the worldview development of young people. And I have to tell you, sadly, that far and away, the greatest influence is not parents. It is the arts and entertainment media. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But parents are the ones who are called to have that level of influence. Now, when we look at some of the issues that parents therefore are facing in being the dominant worldview development influence for their children, there are some things that I'd like you to understand, some profiles of our nation, if you will, that I think are important to get a grip on. Let's talk, first of all, about a group that I'll refer to as theologically identified born-again Christians. It's a mouthful. It'd be so much easier just to say born-again Christians. But the problem is that most research firms and most media journalists talk about born-again Christians based on what I consider to be bad research. And that's research where a firm will go out, they'll do a national survey, and it might do a great job of sampling the population, but then their questions leave something to be desired. And a great example of that to me is when researchers, whether it's Gallup, Pew, whoever, most of them simply go out and ask people, do you consider yourself to be an evangelical or born-again Christian? And I've done a lot of extensive testing on that and other wording of the questions. And what we found is that when you simply ask people to identify themselves based on whatever criteria they may have in mind, and it probably won't be the same criteria or standards as the person sitting next to them or their pastor or their teachers or God, what we get is data, but I think it's unstable and unreliable data. And so I'm going to talk about theologically identified born-again Christians. And by that, I mean these are people who, when you talk to them about what they believe, they say they know that when they die, they will go to heaven or they'll spend eternity in God's presence, but only because they've acknowledged their sins, they've confessed their sins to Jesus, and they've asked him to save them from the consequences of those sins. That's a group that I'm calling theologically identified born-again Christians. Are they going to spend eternity in heaven with God? I don't know. I'm not God. Only he knows. But what I'm trying to do is get the best possible measure so that we can estimate what's going on, so that we can respond strategically to the conditions in which God has placed us. So if we look at theologically identified born-again Christians, pastors that we interview and work with across the country tell us that they're the backbone of the Christian church in America. And yet what we find is that among theologically identified born-again Christians who are parents of children under the age of 13, most of them think they have a biblical worldview. In point of fact, only 8% do. What we know is just 3% of the theologically identified born-again preteen parents qualify as disciples using those six factors that Jesus gave us that we talked about, the three from John, the three from Luke. Only 3% according to those six criteria. What we know is about 9 out of 10 of the theologically identified born-again preteen parents embrace a worldview as their dominant worldview that's known as syncretism. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but I want you to know that that's about as far away from a biblical worldview as you can get. And so we've got an issue here with the dominant worldview of the parents, the Christian, born-again Christian parents of most of our young people. And so consequently, most theologically identified born-again parents of preteens are going to raise their children to be syncretists, because we tend to raise our children to follow in our footsteps spiritually. Not always, there are exceptions, but that's the dominant mode. There's a second issue that we should talk about, and that is something when we broaden our perspective on what are the goals and actions of these theologically identified born-again parents, what do we find out? Well, most of them, as I alluded to, are not disciples. We know that most of them have an inadequate definition of what makes somebody a disciple, biblically speaking. Perhaps if they had a biblical definition, they would work harder to become a true follower of Jesus. We know that most of those parents do not have any kind of plan for how they're going to disciple their children. It's a spontaneous process. And they have some activities that they do regularly, perhaps going to church, maybe opening and reading their Bible and encouraging their children to do that, although most of them don't do that with their children. But they have all of these kinds of activities, but they don't have a real plan. And we find that when you don't have a discipleship plan, the probability of you raising your child to become a true disciple of Jesus is very, very low. We know that most of these theologically identified born-again parents think of discipleship more in terms of transferring information to somebody, such as their children, than they think of it as being a process of allowing the Holy Spirit to completely transform who you are. And so once again, we're shortchanging what discipleship is all about. Jesus never meant for it to be just an exchange of biblical facts. When you study what he did with his disciples, he didn't just sit there and read from the scriptures to them every day. They talked about it. They went out and they did things. They measured how well they were doing. There were all kinds of activities that we'll identify. But most of our parents aren't doing that. Most of the theologically identified born-again parents don't really understand worldview, don't think much about it, and they have no process for developing the worldview of their children. One of the things that I talk about in that book, Raising Spiritual Champions, that I wrote, which is all based on research, we found that most children of these born-again parents don't actually trust their parents. Now, they know their parents love them, but they don't trust them because they watch their parents and they listen to their parents. And what they told us when we interviewed them was, I know my parents love me and they want the best for me and they're trying to do the best they can, but, you know, I listen to them and I watch them and there's a disconnect. They say one thing and do another. And we said, so what difference does that make to you? They said, well, that tells me that they're in the same place I am. They haven't figured it out yet. They're still trying to get it together. And so as a child, therefore, I've got to look elsewhere for my guidance to people who have figured it out. And again, we'll talk about that. We know that what happens with these theologically identified born-again parents is that they tend to heavily rely upon churches or Christian schools for their child's spiritual development. And at the same time, because they love their children and they want the best for them, they actually outsource many of their critical parenting functions. In other words, rather than them doing it, they say, you know what, I'm going to hire the best experts I can find. And so they may have coaches, they may have tutors, they may have pastors, they may have all kinds of other people that they bring around their child, and they expect those people to be doing that developmental work with their children because they figure those people will do it better than they would. But remember, every one of those experts is bringing their worldview into the process and imprinting that on the parent's child. And finally, realize that most parents do nothing to measure the spiritual depth, the spiritual growth, the spiritual trajectory of their children. And so what winds up happening is that when we asked theologically identified born-again parents, so what are your priorities for your children? What they told us was, well, we want them to do really well in school. We want them to have a fun, safe, carefree childhood. And we want them to be in good physical shape so that they live a long, healthy life. In other words, the bottom line for most of our Christian parents, our most Christian of the Christian parents, is that they want their children to be smart and happy and comfortable and healthy. And my question is, but shouldn't we want them to be saved and discipled and moral and joyful? The very things that Jesus died for, the very things that the Great Commission calls us to instill in the minds and the hearts of our children. What we know is that you can't give what you don't have. The fact that most Christian parents don't have a biblical worldview means they couldn't give their children one if they wanted to. And so their worldview is going to be left deficient. We know that you're not going to teach what you don't know or believe. And therefore, the biblical principles that America's children desperately need probably aren't going to be coming forth from their parents. We know that you will not model that which you do not represent. And so the lifestyle of our children, we can see it out in the streets today, out in our schools today, everywhere where children are. Most of them do not exhibit a biblical lifestyle. We know that you're not going to measure things that you don't consider to be important. And measurement is critical because you get what you measure. It's one of the key principles I teach all my students at the university, is that the things that you measure are being measured because you recognize those as being critical to the kinds of outcomes that you think are most important. And yet we don't measure these kinds of things in the lives of our children. And you're not going to measure things that you don't consider to be important. And ultimately, one of the key principles of discipleship is you reproduce who you are. Why? Because of the things we just talked about. You give what you have. You teach what you know. You model those things through your lifestyle. And then you measure those very things because you believe those are important. So we're in this situation where right now the ineffectiveness, the inefficacy of Christian parents can and must be changed, because if we keep going down the path we've been going, it's not going to turn out well. Now, I get some common reactions to this when I talk about it publicly. A lot of parents say, well, don't worry about it. You know, even if we're not discipling our children, it's really not our responsibility anyway. We can't do it very effectively. We're leaving that up to a church or Christian schools. But what we know is that from our research, we can tell you most churches don't take the spiritual growth of children seriously. What we know is that less than one out of every 40 Protestant churches even focuses at all on the worldview development of the children to whom they have exposure. We know that less than one out of every 100 Protestant churches has any kind of a validated worldview assessment process to gauge the worldview of their children. And most children's pastors could not effectively teach a biblical worldview even if they wanted to, because only 12% of the children's pastors in Christian churches in America today actually have a biblical worldview. See, churches in America today are not effectively discipling people, whether we're talking about adults or teenagers or young children. Most churches are not committed to biblical worldview development. Now, a large majority of the pastors of our Protestant churches think they're doing an excellent or very good job of developing the worldview of their congregants. But again, that's because they confuse the transfer of information with the transformation of lives. We're pretty good at transferring information. We're pretty good at building relationships. What the research shows is we're awful at facilitating the transformation of people's lives based on the truths of that information and the benefit of those relationships. And so what we've got to do is change that process. One of the reasons why churches aren't focused on that is because less than one out of every 100 Protestant churches has any kind of a validated worldview assessment process to gauge or assess the worldview of their adults. They have no idea what their people believe. But because they're teaching from the Bible, hopefully consistently, they figure, well, everything's going swell. But even look at our pastors and what we've done to them in the seminary and Bible college and elsewhere, certainly the culture's impact. What we know is that there is no group of pastors, whether we're talking about senior pastors, associate pastors, teaching pastors, children's pastors, executive pastors. We did a national survey with all these different groups of pastors currently serving in our churches. It's a minority of each of those groups where those pastors have a biblical worldview. And remember what we said before, you can't give what you don't have. You're not going to teach what you don't believe. You're not going to model something that you aren't. And so we've got an issue there. Another common question I got is, well, listen, if we're just, you know, hoping for the best, if we're doing the best we can from day to day, parents would say, you know, aren't our children just going to ease into being a disciple of Jesus thanks to the cumulative impact of what we and churches and schools are doing? And the answer is a resounding no, absolutely not. We know that from the research we're doing. If that were true, that young people would just ease into genuine discipleship of Jesus, we would have more than 3% of our current adult population who are disciples. But having done this now for 40 years, I can show you the curves indicating that with each succeeding year, we are having fewer and fewer people who have a biblical worldview. And fewer people who qualify by Jesus' 6 criteria as a genuine disciple of his. What we know is that churches are not focused on making disciples. They're focused on putting people through discipleship programs. And what we've discovered is that those programs are not producing disciples. So they're really not discipleship programs. What we know is that families are not making disciples. What they're trying to do is to raise happy, safe, well-rounded, academically astute children. And that's good. That's something that we should be doing, but not to the exclusion of first and foremost making sure that they're disciples of Jesus. We know that the life objectives set for and by children tend to exclude discipleship in the list of things that matter to them most and the things that they're going to invest themselves in. We know that American culture itself no longer respects or celebrates disciples of Jesus. In fact, just the opposite in many cases. And so we come back to that truism, you get what you measure. But the reality is almost nobody is measuring discipleship. And so we're getting what we measure. We don't care about discipleship, and we're not getting many disciples. So that's really the point that I'm trying to make here. You know, the point is that we are in a war, a literal war, for the hearts and the minds and the souls of America's children. They cannot exist without a worldview. And so what they're doing is they're embracing the worldview taught to them by the authorities that they trust. Remember, this goes back to trust. And what they're going to do is develop a worldview, but it's highly unlikely that it's going to be a biblical worldview. And so I talked before about who has the greatest influence on our children. I talked about arts and entertainment media. And some people have asked me a really good question, which is, but why would our children trust television or movies or video games or social media or any music, any of those different media that they spend hour after hour with every day? Well, it's because when you talk with your parents and they tell you what to do and then you watch them and they do the opposite, that tells you, okay, it can't be real. It's not true. It's not something I should be following. Because if it were real, they'd be consistent between their language and their behavior, what they say they believe and what they actually do. But why the media? Because when you watch a two-hour movie or a 27-minute program, 24 minutes after you take out the commercials, you know, you listen to a four-minute pop song, you play a video game for 40 minutes. During that time, the people who produced that bit of media provide a very consistent message or set of messages. They're internally consistent with each other. And so that's why when kids watch a movie, they say, ah, I see how it works. They listen to what they've said. They watch what they do. It fits together. Say, okay, I get it. And they imitate that. Same thing with music, same thing with books or, you know, whatever it is that they're looking at. So this is what we've got to be apprised of. And if you're a parent or if you're a grandparent, I'd like you to ask yourself, so having heard all this and thinking about it and considering what the Holy Spirit might be stirring up, hopefully is stirring up within you, the question becomes, so what's the most significant life outcome for which you must equip your child or your grandchild, or if you're a coach or a teacher, the children that you get to influence in those environments? What could be a better parenting or grandparenting or coaching outcome than producing disciples of Jesus? If you have a better one, I really hope you'll write to me and let me know what it is, because I can't think of a better one. And as I read scripture, I don't think there is one. So with our remaining time, let's turn to some practical strategies and tactics related to how to disciple a child. We start off by remembering that you do what you believe. So without that biblical worldview, you're not going to think like Jesus. Unless you think like Jesus, you're not going to act like Jesus. A genuine disciple imitates their master. So if you don't act like Jesus, chances are really, really good that you're not truly his disciple. We can look again at a lot of the data. You know, I've just given you the conceptual framework, but the statistical realities, 2 out of 3 people in this country call themselves Christians. About half of those people are what we refer to as theologically identified born-again Christians. Among the self-identified Christians, about half claim they have a biblical worldview. Only 6% do. Among the theologically identified born-again Christians, 2/3 of them say they have a biblical worldview. Only 1 out of every 8 actually does. And did you ever wonder why the Christian churches in America have so little influence? Well, it has to do with the fact that, you know, when we look at those discipleship criteria, again, numbers are abysmal. 2/3 of people claim they're disciples of Jesus. Only 2% of those self-identified Christians actually meet the Jesus criteria. or among the theologically identified born again, 4 out of 5 claim that they're disciples, but only 5% meet the criteria. And a final thing I'd like to leave with you statistically here related to this is that biblical worldview is so critically important that what we discovered is that 70%, 7 out of 10 adults who have a biblical worldview also qualify by Jesus' 6 criteria as disciples. Yet, among the adults who do not have a biblical worldview, only less than 1% qualify as disciples. So that biblical worldview is crucially important. You know, I'm a big baseball fan. So one of the things that I like to equate this to is it'd be like believing that you could be a disciple of Jesus without a biblical world is as ridiculous as claiming that you could hit a home run without possessing a bat. You just can't do it. You need to have the right tools to get the job done. And that biblical worldview is the tool that you need to truly become a disciple of Jesus. Now, what we're doing right now is pursuing worldview by default, not by design. We're letting it spontaneously emerge in the life of our children. You know, parents love their children, but it turns out that they're not prioritizing the discipling of their children. Churches don't prioritize either equipping parents to disciple their children or biblical worldview development and discipling of children. Public schools, of course, either ignore or dismiss or distort or attack Christianity. And the arts and entertainment media consistently provide worldview messages, but they're not biblical worldview messages. And so that's why the child's worldview develops by default. If we can help them to get a truly biblical worldview, their life will be radically different than if they don't have one. Our research shows that people who have that biblical worldview just are more likely than people who don't have one to describe their lives as happier, fulfilling, to have longer lasting, happier marriages, to have more of a clear sense of the purpose of their life, to enjoy satisfying relationships, to be more forgiving of other people, to regularly engage in serving others, to be active in the community, to regularly participate in a range of spiritual activities, such as prayer, reading the Bible, and worshiping God, and to say that they actively receive strength from their faith. They're also much less likely to say that they often feel anxious or depressed or fearful, which is now becoming a majority condition in our culture among young adults. What we know is that they're less likely to spend time in jail or prison or to be responsible for bringing about an abortion. They're less likely to succumb to an addiction or to support same-sex marriage. They're less likely, much less likely, to feel afraid to die or to experience a divorce or to lie or to steal or to have sexual relations outside of marriage or to have some kind of a homosexual or LGBTQ relationship. Worldview matters hugely, but how do you get there? But I'd like to suggest to you that what we have to think about providing for our children or whoever we're discipling is what we would consider to be an immersive worldview experience. Now, what does that mean? One of the reasons why I teach at Arizona Christian University is because it's the first university I've found that has an immersive worldview development experience for its students. That's very intentional, it's very strategic, very consistent. One of the things I love about our school is that some of the best disciple makers on our campus are our coaches. They say they love the sport that they coach, but they don't coach because they want to win in that sport. They coach because they know they're going to have a lot of intimate group experiences with a group of young men or young women. And that enables them to disciple them in ways that they ordinarily couldn't. But that's the mindset of the disciple maker, always looking at every situation as an opportunity to be growing the spiritual life of the person that they're raising in the Lord. And so that immersive experience simply means that everything that goes on in the child's life, and I'm going to speak here about children, everything that goes on in that child's life, we want to be bringing back to Jesus, bringing back to biblical principles, bringing back to those 6 definitional factors of what it means to be a genuine disciple of Jesus. How do we do that? We do it through conversation. And one of the things that's important here is to recognize that the conversations we have not only build our relationship with our children, build that trust with them, but it gives us the opportunity to dig into the deeper things of life with our kids, if we're willing to go there. The kids probably are not going to take us there very often. We're going to have to look for those opportunities. But conversation, relationship, reflection, encouraging people to think. One of the things I've learned in 40-some years of research in America is that Americans don't like to think. We like to do. The reason that America has become a great nation is that we're a nation of doers. We see opportunities and we exploit them to the best of our ability. But very frequently, we don't stop to think about the implications of what we're doing. And that's certainly true in our spiritual lives. And so we need to actively encourage our children to spend some time in meditation, just reflecting, not Eastern meditation, but meditating on the things of God, the spiritual principles that we're trying to get them to embrace, and what it looks like in their life. Every experience, every activity they have, trying to bring that back to now. What did this have to do with biblical principles? How does that give you an opportunity to advance God's kingdom, to honor and respect the Lord and so forth? See, it all comes back to Deuteronomy 6. That passage is so critical to helping us understand what it means to be a parent. And I love, verses 4-9, particularly those where it talks about with your children, impress these things on your children, talk about them. When you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up, tie these things as symbols on your hands, bind them on your foreheads, write them on the door frames of your homes and your gates to your property. Everywhere you go, be thinking Christ. Be thinking about how you can make Christ and his life principles real to your children. That's what this passage reminds us is so critical. What kinds of content should be embedded in these conversations, these relationships, these experiences, all these opportunities? One of the things that we do at the university is we've tried to distill, what do the scriptures teach? How do they teach it? What things go together? And so we've come up with all kinds of categories of content that we intentionally think about incorporating into what we teach, into what we talk, into how we relate, into the different experiences that we offer on campus. And that's the same kind of thing we want to do with our children and grandchildren. And so maybe you'll come up with a different list. This is not a scripture, but, you know, have some idea of, yeah, exactly what is it that we're trying to get across. I don't care if you have a different list. Just don't do this spontaneously all the time. Have something in mind of what you're trying to do. What you want is for it, again, to be something that is comprehensive with the scriptures. And that's what we're trying to get across. But recognize that the challenge is that there are dozens of worldviews that children can choose from. And so we have to guide them very carefully through the options. If you look at the many different worldviews that they've got, they're being exposed to them every single day, primarily through the media. The arts and entertainment media, the news and information media, they're constantly bombarding our children with that kind of information. But so are the movies and the television programs and the music and the videos that they watch. And so we've got to be very strategic in what it is that we're allowing them to be exposed to and how it is that they're being taught what is right, what is real, what is true, what is good, what is appropriate. See, because what's happening in America, we talked earlier about syncretism and about how that's the dominant worldview in America. Syncretism is basically saying, I'm not going to buy into one worldview. I'm going to take bits and pieces from many different worldviews because that makes me feel good. I like these things. They make sense to me. They make me feel safe and secure. They bring me happiness. I think ultimately they'll generate fulfillment in my life. And so even if some of it is from Marxism, some of it's from secular humanism, some of it's from Eastern mysticism, some of it's from the Bible, I'm going to bring all those things together into something that works for me. See, because part of our worldview is that we're the center of creation. And so we've got to attack that first and foremost and recognize, no, we're not. But then what we want to do is to make sure that our children are not doing what most people do, which is basing their worldview on their feelings. We need to base worldview on truth, and there is only one genuine source of truth, and that is God. God is the embodiment of truth, and the Bible teaches us that. And we also know that the Bible teaches us God's truth, because he knew that we needed it in writing in order to get through our lives, because we'd mess it up if we did it on our own, and that's exactly what syncretism is proving, that we messed it up when we went off the rails and tried to figure it out on our own. We've got to get back to his word and be teaching these things to our children. Syncretism is America's dominant worldview because it makes us feel good. It gives us choices. We like choices. We like to be in control. But we've got to help our children understand why that's dangerous. What we want them to do is to draw from biblical theism, which is what a biblical worldview is. That's the scholarly name for it. But that's bringing them back to having a worldview that enables them to experience and interpret and respond to reality in ways that are always consistent with biblical principles. That's the thing that will enable them to think like Jesus so that they can then live like Jesus. Today in our culture, we've got a lot of issues. If we look inside the minds and the hearts of today's young people, the worldview aspects that we're finding that young people are latching onto are things like feelings are more important than facts. There's no purpose to life. So you can do whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. You're going to get what you deserve, this idea of karma, what goes around comes around. There's no source of grace that we can rely upon. There's no transcendent God that exists. There are moral choices that we make, but they're all equal. As long as you feel good about your choice, that's the right choice for you. There's no basis for trusting any philosophy of life. History itself is meaningless. There's really nothing to learn from it. There's no rescue from failure. There's no inherent value to life. Just do what you can in the moment because there's really nothing guaranteed beyond it. Nothing is going to happen after you die. There's no kind of relationship that you can have with the divine being because there is no such divine being. And therefore, there's no eternal hope. There are no external truths. Life, anything goes. And there's no kind of predictable authority, and there's certainly no single faith that you can always rely upon to be truthful and helpful. How do you combat this? I'd suggest that you start with something called the seven cornerstones of a biblical worldview. Again, this comes out of our research, looking at how do people develop a biblical worldview? What's most important in that? And what we found is that there are seven very simple core beliefs that form a very solid foundation upon which you can build a complete biblical worldview. These seven cornerstones are not the whole worldview. But if you own these, not just you give them lip service, not just, I pretty much believe those. No, you own them. They become part of your identity, part of who you are, part of what your life is about. That's ownership of those principles. Then you've got a solid foundation you can build on. Any parent, no matter how spiritually undeveloped you are, can do this. A lot of parents come up to me and they say, I don't have a biblical worldview. And you said, I can't give what I don't have. What am I going to do? You start with the seven cornerstones. See, one of the beauties of being a parent or a grandparent, you've only got to be about 10 seconds ahead of your kids. They don't know the difference. They don't know what you know and don't know, but what you're going to be saying to them or doing for them to show them how it looks. So you get here first, and then you make sure that you share this with them in every appropriate way that you can. See, in these seven cornerstones, I go into these in the book, Raising Spiritual Champion, very, very simply. You say, whoa, what is this? This is Sunday School 101. I learned this when I was 5 years old. Well, you may have been taught it, but chances are, based on the data, you don't own it. And so I'm suggesting, you know, if you can own these seven cornerstones, you know, that God does exist, and it talks about the biblical nature of God, why he exists, how we know he exists, what difference it makes that he exists, the fact that we are not him, we're sinners, by our very nature from the moment we're born. And that there's only one antidote to that sin problem that we have, and that's Jesus Christ. And that we know this because we're taught that in the Bible. The Bible is true, it's relevant, it's reliable. And we also know that the Bible contains absolute moral truths for us to live by, and it lays those out for us. And we know that the Bible tells us that success is nothing more, nothing less than consistent obedience to God. Has nothing to do with money or houses or reputation or anything else. Consistently obeying God. And that our purpose on earth is to know, love, and serve God with all our heart, mind, strength, and soul. You say, but that's so simple. Yes, but imagine if you own this in your mind and your heart. You believe it, therefore you live it. What a difference that's going to make. Believing that there is a God, believing that you are by nature a sinner, believing that you need Jesus Christ every moment of every day, that when you sin, there's still hope for you, that you don't have to give up, that you can know when you're sinning because you're reading the Bible, you know what the Bible teaches. The Bible gives you absolute mercy. I mean, you just go through all these things. They fit together and they give you what you need. It's interesting that when we look at what works in discipleship, it's very simple stuff, and it's all the stuff that Jesus did. You know, we talked earlier about a biblical worldview is something that you want to believe and to apply and to share. And so how do you get a young person to do that? Well, first of all, you start with your relationship with them. If you're going to help them to become a disciple of Jesus, you've got to have a deep relationship with them. And that relationship needs to be on them trusting you. You build that trust by investing time in that relationship and by sharing experiences with them. And then what you do is you have conversations with them throughout that relationship. Not just any conversation where you're saying, yeah, the sky is a beautiful blue, but it's Socratic conversations, where you're constantly asking them questions about what they believe and why they believe it and what difference that makes in their life. And that's what gives you the opportunity then to start showing them an alternative to what they've bought into or what their friends have bought into or what their other teachers are professing to them. And not only conversation, but you also want to be able to share stories with them, maybe Bible stories, maybe stories out of your own life. But at any rate, stories sell the message. And ultimately, when it comes to applying it, yes, you want to model it for them because they're not going to buy any of that unless you show them what it looks like in your own life. And then you want to consistently measure, are we making progress here? Today, when we measure the seven cornerstones in the lives of children, most of them are not being exposed to this. Most of them are not owning the seven cornerstones. And so what that tells us, because we know the relationship between this and somebody developing a biblical worldview, is the future of America in terms of worldview is a dark one, because our children are being led down different paths, not the biblical worldview path. If you want to know how they're doing, we developed an assessment, an online assessment. Anybody can look at the questions that we use to measure somebody's worldview. Find out what is your dominant worldview. We've got a version for children. We've got a version for adults. And so you can check that out. And over the course of time, you can see what kind of differences there are. But remember the context in all of this. It is an absolute war for the mind and the heart and the soul of everyone in our country. You've got to prioritize disciple-making because that's what God put you here on earth for. And remember that you're going to be most effective when you work with children. They're in that vulnerable space in their lives where their worldview is developing, and that's going to determine whether or not they become a disciple of Jesus. But children in America are cultural targets. And the culture war is essentially won or lost by how effectively we influence our children to become disciples of Jesus. Your job as a parent or a grandparent isn't to be popular. It's not to make those children happy. It's not to make them feel comfortable or secure. It's to help them become disciples of Jesus. What matters most? Focus on that. Focus on the mission. Go make disciples and start with every child that you can influence. Thank you for being here. God bless you.